Call the State Affairs Committee meeting to order, please. I'd like to welcome everybody. We will be a little bit short on members this morning since there's so many people that have excused absences, so but we will proceed as long as we have quorum. And I want to thank Lori and Steve for their assistance over on the equipment and Nancy for getting us going here in the morning with all the stuff we have here. And the committee members that are present are Representative Johnson, Coghill, Dahl, and myself, Roses. And we do have excused absences today for both Representative Lynn and Representative Johansson. So we will proceed first with House Bill 406, continuation from the last meeting. And I believe we have a CS before us. If somebody would like to move to adopt the CS as a working draft.
Mr. Chairman. I'll go ahead and move that we adopt for work today the CS for House Bill 406, version E, that is dated 3-11-08.
Thank you. Representative Faircloth, would you like to fill us in on what the changes are?
Mr. Chairman, committee members, thank you for hearing HB 406 this morning. You raised valid questions at the last hearing, and I had met with procurement and the Division of Elections directly after the meeting and followed up with an email to each of you outlining the changes that would be provided in the CS. All those have occurred. I'll let everyone speak for themselves, but it's my understanding that we have concurrence on the timing issues and the exclusion of the ballot bidding process outside of the procurement code because of the timing issues raised by Representative Coghill. Ballots were had to be follow the regular procurement procedure, it would be an arduous process to get something done on time, especially in a special election when something needed to come forward. So the process issue, I believe, will meet your satisfaction inside the new CS. Representative Dahl asked us about the timing in the fiscal note. I spoke with Gail at the Division of Elections, and she believed that there would be no additional time. There would be a difference in priority of a workload at a particular point in time, but there is no fiscal note on this bill, and they believe that they could have a competitive bid process under a bidder proposal that's outlined in the new CS, so they saw no increase in fiscal obligations for them. The certification process, I have not heard back from Gail on. She had a call in yesterday to what is now Premier Elections that used to be Diebold that was formerly Global. Is Gail here? Gail can speak to that if she has further information. I did respond to you, and I'll put on the record that rumor has it, and that's all that we can say, just like when we had testimony from someone calling in that rumor had it, it was because of liability issues. So I just bring that to the forefront that was one of the rumors we heard. And the rumor that I heard yesterday was that actually when Global originally, or the original developer of the hardware, had proprietary purchase options or provider options on the balloting. And so in order to make them the preferred provider, they developed a certification process so that no one else could compete against those who were building and selling the hardware. But Gail was going to follow up to see if that was correct, and I'm happy.
Thank you, Gail. Would you state your name and position for the record again, please?
Sure. Gail Fanumi, Division of Elections Director. I did speak with Premier Election Systems, formerly known as Diebold, formerly known as Global Election Systems, about the printer certification process, and I was informed that it was started as a courtesy to customers because at the time, the optical scan, and I'm okay, sorry. At the time the optical scan technology came out, it was brand new technology. Customers were concerned about printers being able to print the ballots properly so they would be able to be fed into the AccuVote units and read properly. So the service was started as a courtesy to customers because the customers had asked for it. The company got too big. It became not economically feasible for them to continue that process. It was not something that was required of Premier Election Systems. And then also Premier then purchased a printing company and determined they had a conflict of interest if they continued to do that. And so that's the reason certification of printers ceased.
Thank you.
Chairman, please. If I might follow up, Alaska state law does not require the certification. It is a quality measure, and one of the reasons that we chose the proposal versus a competitive bid and changed the language in the CS was so that the Division of Elections, because of the testimony by the current provider and the honor and the integrity of the system, that they would, inside of the RFP process, outline those points that are of utmost importance for reading those ballots in the request for proposal. I don't know if...
Through the chair, Mr. Chairman. That's correct. The bid proposal process would allow the division to, like we discussed before, add extra things that could be evaluated instead of simply just lowest bid.
Thank you.
Mr. Chairman, the last issue that I believe was raised by the committee, and appropriately so, was the issue of length of time for an individual printer to have the award or the contract. And it was proposed by Representative Johnson that maybe we should consider 5 years so that we had some longevity and that we would have faith in a bidder. But in fact, after conversation with the procurement and with the Division of Elections, it's my understanding, and they will speak for themselves, that 1 year is better because we can hold them accountable to make sure that they're performing in a timely manner as well as the quality that we need. And that the Division of Elections would, from our conversations inside the RFP proposal or the request for proposal, offer that on an odd year, not into a general and a primary and a general election, but when in the off year when they have other printing, to make sure that printer can perform before we get to a general election.
That's correct.
Representative Dole?
Yes, going back to the certification process, I can see there are some valid reasons to have that, despite the, you know, the what was it, $5,000 per, and all the different kinds of questions we might have come around that certification process. But so how do we know that, is there going to be a testing period on that RFP, for example? I mean, before you award the contract, I mean, can they print out a ballot and actually see if it's fed through correctly? And I mean, I can see a disastrous effect if they won something and we 20 days or 15 days before the election, we try it out and it doesn't meet the holes and doesn't do all the right things. And what are we doing with that?
Through the chair, Representative Dahl, the Division of Elections is very competent, and inside of their request for proposal, they would have those specific specifications. One of the previous holder that is doing the work provided us the ballot specifications, which I'll pass on to the Division of Elections. I'm sure they're already aware of that, but he was very kind in FedExing us to them so that we knew specifically what his business could provide. But just for the edification of the committee, other printers around the states are providing printing services to AccuVote systems in a manner that has been successful in running elections, specifically in Anchorage. There is a competitive bid process there already, and there are printers that are vying for that service. I should note one other thing in the ballot. Through the chair, Representative Dahl, did that answer your question?
Yeah, I'm just, you know, you're concerned. We had a recount one time, and it's interesting. If something is just not, you know, exactly within a hair, even less than a hair, it cannot be counted. And so it concerns me that you can follow written specifications, but unless you go through a testing, it may not work. So.
And through the chair, Representative Dahl, I believe the current process, the printer, as they are printing official ballots, runs them through a testing process to make sure the timing marks are in the correct spots. The folding marks don't infringe on the timing marks, because the timing marks are what is the major concern, because that's how then the oval is filled in and that's how the ballots
right.
actually counted.
Right. Okay.
So we would make sure that there are testing procedures in place for that.
All right. Thank you.
Mr. Chairman, and just to follow up, when we said 1 year, or when I stated 1 year, it would be the request for proposal would be 1 year with multiple years of renewal options to be determined at the proposal. So it could be somewhere in excess of 1 year with 6 or 8 years of 1 year renewal options if that printer is successful in doing that.
Representative Faircloth, is that option designed to be a two-way street, or is it a one-way? Is it an only option exercised by the state, or is it an option that's also exercised by the printer?
Mr. Chairman, that would be determined in the request for proposal to see if the printer wanted to be under the state's specifications.
Any other questions? Representative Duff?
I do have a question, but it's on a different point.
That's fine. But as long as it's on this bill, it doesn't matter.
Yes. All right. this was actually for the sponsor. Representative Fairclough, could you kind of lead me through this new proposed language? I was looking at page 4, line 5, and frankly, I didn't understand. It looked to me was that I didn't see anything new in that. So I'm not quite sure what you...
Line 4 is actually the start of the change for mm-hmm. that. And the words that are new is advantageous offer. And so the committee spoke to quality control, mm-hmm. And that's what advantageous offer is. But I'll let procurement speak to that. They are terms of art in the procurement code.
State your name. And
my name is Vern Jones, Chief Procurement Officer. Through the chair, Representative Dahl. We use the term advantageous to simply mean that this is the proposal deemed most beneficial to the state through evaluation criteria that's published in the RFP. So in other words, it scored the highest on the evaluation criteria that's published in the RFP, and then we through that process have decided it has more advantages considering all those factors, including price, than all the other proposals that are received and evaluated.
When you first testified, and we had the bill up, I had a very strong sense of the fact that you weren't too awfully comfortable with what a bill would do, and you actually felt as though it would be an impediment to being able to get things done in a timely fashion. Do these changes in this bill make you feel more comfortable and you're fairly secure that your department can carry out the wishes that this bill outlines?
Mr. Chairman, when the bill first surfaced, it would be a low bid takes all situation. I was concerned about ambiguities about timing and whether procurement code requirements for things like bid circulation time, protest period, and official written notice, and that all that takes time. So I was concerned with the division not being able to adequately specify in a low bid situation. I was concerned about timing. I think that the changes made here address some of that. It addresses obviously the being able to list a number of factors in addition to price so that we feel like we get the best value and the best quality, not necessarily the lowest price, but price is always an evaluation factor in our RFPs. I'm also since been convinced that given the timing and the plan to have term contracts in lieu of individual yearly or election cycle contracts, that the division will be able to go out with enough time, get a contractor on board, and meet their time frames.
Okay. Thank you. Representative Burke.
Mr. Chairman, one area of difference between procurement and myself is an Alaska product means. And that is defined in Alaska state statute, so I didn't want Burns being very kind of not having raised that issue. But I'd like him to speak to that, but I'll tell you what I know about it. Alaska product, and I included it in my email to you.
Excuse me, does that term appear in the bill?
Yes, it does.
Where?
On page 4. Under 1515.031, which is a new section totally. On line 28, it defines what an Alaska product is.
Where does the term appear elsewhere? That's the definition. Where does that?
It doesn't appear elsewhere.
Then why is there a definition? Oh, here it is. It's on line 8.
On line 8, it's giving a preference of an additional 7%. My intent is, though, that Alaskans get awarded the contract. But when I did some research, I found and sent to you in an email that only one printer, and it is not the current printer, has an Alaska product certificate in Alaska right now. I contacted Kevin Fraley, I believe, who is the current bidder and has done, again, I state, a wonderful job for the record. And he assured me that he had been an Alaska product provider before and had that certificate. And I told him, looking at the window of opportunity inside of the Commerce, Renee, Department of Commerce, that's where that certificate comes out of. And it is unique. It's the only service that we could find under the Alaska product quote for printing. But again, other printers, and I just put out for the record, it doesn't cost money to get it. It only establishes a number ranking for how much of your service is actually printed, and that product is made inside of the state of Alaska. And so, again, I'm trying to make sure Alaska contractors are awarded printing bids from the state. So that's why I support that preferential in this product. But if Vern might see that differently.
Mr. Chairman.
Vern, did you wish to comment on that? Or?
Yes, sir. Mr. Chair, the sponsor's intent, obviously, she stated, to make sure that this job goes to an Alaskan firm, and I support that, of course. I think because of the logistics involved, it almost has to. There's, in addition to printing, there's a lot of shipping to many sites, of course. My only fear, my only reservation with the Alaska product preferences is, as the sponsor noted, there's currently only one vendor there in that forms category. All the others that are presumably qualified and residing in Alaska would certainly qualify to obtain that preference. My only fear is that the timing involved, the list is published only twice a year. It takes about 30 days, I understand, for the commerce staff to go through and qualify a firm to put it on the list, but then it's only published twice a year, and the timing could be such that, for example, a new printer comes on in the state. They may miss a cycle. They may not qualify for the preference, and if that were the case, it would, in my opinion, sort of serve to distinguish one Alaskan firm over another Alaskan firm for the most part. My suggestion would be that you might consider eliminating that preference and simply increasing the Alaska bidder preference. It would have the same effect, and the printers wouldn't have to go through this process, which I guess, in my opinion, if you're in Alaska, if you're printing, I don't know what purpose that serves.
Okay. Is that on this particular?
Yeah, absolutely.
Okay, because Johnson had his hand up first, but go ahead.
And I don't know. I am concerned this doesn't go to judiciary. Are there legal opinions as to the constitutionality of these provisions under the Commerce Clause or anything else? Either one of you, through the chair.
To my knowledge, through the chair, Representative Grunberg, I know of no opinions about the product preference. I think that on the other hand, the bidder preference has been vetted several times and has survived the lawsuits, I believe.
Oh, it has. And for these preferences, the offeror and it's not a bid anymore, so I assume you mean Alaska offeror is a term.
Through the chair, that would be the proposer, the person who submits a proposal.
The reason is because the 5% and the 7% are so substantial, it may essentially knock anybody else out, particularly if there's only one firm that qualifies. And I'm concerned about two things. Number one, the timing. If this has got to go through a lawsuit, the administrative law judge, I don't know if they would even look at the constitutionality of this, or would have to go up on an appeal to the Superior Court and then the Supreme Court. That could really, particularly the first time around, slow the process down considerably and also increase the cost, because there's a considerable cost in litigating these things. And I don't know that we want to push the envelope, at least right away, on this.
Representative Faircloth, you want to respond?
Mr. Chairman, the Alaska product is defined in 363338 and has been in code for, if I'm reading this right, at least since 1986, that we do have an Alaska product preference.
You have that site again. You were too fast. No, just I've got the book.
3338.
Definitions under the procurement code.
36.
30.
Yeah.
338.
33.
Page 400.
Okay, I'm getting there.
Nice that we all have the same book.
I see. Go ahead.
It's part of how we establish Alaska products in the state, so I believe it has met.
The definition is different there than your definition, and that's the thing that concerns me. If I may, Mr. Chair, read the current definition. Means a product of which not less than 25% of the value is determined in accordance with regulations adopted under AS 3633.32a has been added, has been added by manufacturer, manufacturing or production in the state, and that is different than this definition here at the bottom of page 4.
It's not. It refers to that. That's what I cite on line 30 is tell you that it's as defined in that subsection.
Yes, but that's only A. Then you have to add subsections B and C. Those are not in the current definition as I read it.
We did not define product or recycled Alaska product. That's under the certification that if anyone got the certification that they would go through?
Well, through the chair, the terms produced or manufactured is defined in the current statute. But what you have in here, and this is really, I haven't had a chance to study this, really, line 31 says, for in addition to the sub A, and by the way, it only refers to 338 sub 2, does not refer back. I think we need to probably distribute this statute so the members can see what I'm talking about. It's a different definition, the way I read it. We're looking here, right here, that statute. I'm sorry.
Mr. Chairman, we have legal prepare it to be Alaska product that would fall under the certification from the Department of Commerce, thank you. And if it doesn't meet that, I'm happy to amend it to do that. But this is what the Department of Law or Legislative Legal gave to us as
a definition. All I'm saying, Mr. Chair, is that it is different than the current definition. I'd ask Mr. Jones, do you agree that it's different than the current definition?
Through the chair, Representative Gruenberg, I'm not so certain, given that this bill references that statute. Maybe I'm in a bit over my head, want to give an opinion on that.
Folks, you'll just have to look at it yourselves and make your decision.
Mr. Representative Cockett, yes, go ahead.
Another point Representative Gruenberg addressed is the magnitude of the preference. I should, in all fairness, point out that even though you've got two preferences adding up to 12%. The way the RFP works, cost isn't going to be 100%. These preferences act on cost. So, for example, if the evaluation factor for cost was 50%, these preferences would, in essence, equate to a 6% advantage to an Alaskan firm.
Representative Cockell on this point or another one?
No.
Representative Johnson?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I want to go back to the to the five-year versus one-year. And I have been in a situation where I bid on state and federal contracts, and I will tell you that you will save considerable money if you give it to someone for 5 years with the ability to check every year and cancel if they don't perform and spell that out in the RFP. So just as a for the record and as an advisory, and I'm sure you've been involved with this enough to know that the longer term they can buy paper, there are certain savings involved in what they can do. So I think that's something to look at. I certainly don't have a problem with doing it the way you've outlined, but I just wanted to be on the record as the longer term you can make it with the outs that allow you to get out every time, that will save you money and ensure quality because they're going to have a considerable investment in it. So it's almost just the opposite of logic. When they invest that much money in buying that much paper, they want to make sure they do a great job so they can keep that. So I just wanted to put that on the record for procurement to to take a look at extending the contract, but I don't think there's anything in here that precludes you from doing it.
Any other questions?
Just
Representative Dawkins.
Going back to the new wording in section on page 4, starting at that line 4, you mentioned that I'm just curious about the wording and if this is just words that are used all the time. Advantageous, it's preparation of election ballots, the most advantageous offer. And then later you say to the most advantageous, responsive, and responsible offer. Are these is this just sort of, usual kinds of language that you use all the time, or did you pick these particularly? I'm just curious because everything is always tested in court, and I'm just and they're not defined, so I was just curious of how you selected the words.
Through the chair, Representative Dahl, the term advantageous is a term of art we use in procurement very commonly across the country. It simply means that it has more advantages than another proposal, and that is based on the evaluation for the scoring.
I see. So it's boilerplate.
In accordance with the evaluation language. Criteria that's okay. Published in the RFP, and I think you could probably find a Black's Law definition of advantageous. Right. Responsive and responsible are procurement terms that I believe are defined in either statute or regulation. Responsive means that they are in accordance with all the terms and conditions placed in the request for proposal. Responsible just means that they have the ability to perform, and that sometimes involves checking their.
My question was just simply was a boilerplate language, and apparently it is, and everyone understands the terms. Thank you.
Any further questions from the committee? Representative Greenberg?
Yeah. And I'm sorry I was a little bit late to me. And where does it say the five-year period through the chair?
Mr. Chairman, it does not. Representative Johnson asked for a consideration, just like he did today, that the state would be in a better position to award a longer contract. But the Division of Elections believed that the one-year with a one-year renewal provided the term that he was looking for, that they certainly wouldn't write it for 2 years, and that they would look to a longer period of time that best fit their cycle. But what we had talked about and what I relayed and emailed both Gail and Vern was that something like a 6 or 8 year period, but all of them 1 year increments to make sure that they had pressure to hold on a printer, both for cost and quality control. And so their preference was to allow them to use that definition of time inside of the RFP proposal.
Okay, if I may, on a different, slightly different subject.
Please.
I would like to look on line 14 of page 4. The word staffed. You maintain a place of business, that would mean you would legally have a place of business here in this state. Even though it could be locked on the door, you'd have it there legally. Staffed, what does the word staffed mean? Because you could have something that's staffed, you could say Joe Jones, manager, and that would be staffed even though Joe was out of the state most of the time, or all the time.
Through the chair, Representative Gruenberg, I could tell you how that phrasing is from the existing Alaska bidder preference in statute, and how we interpret that is that that the firm has to have a physical presence in the state, have to have some office or warehouse or what have you, and that they have to actually have employees on site, either the owner or employees of the owner, doing the work. What that does for us is it eliminates someone who might go and rent a suite in a professional office building somewhere and have a phone set up and post office box and phones answered out of state. So it's a shell of a farce of a presence in Alaska. So that's what we use it for, and that's how we interpret it.
If I may follow up.
Please.
It sounds like that term, is a term of art defined by the agency's common law?
Through the chair, I'm not certain about
that. There's a body of law and decisions that define that. And also the term advantageous. I just want on the record, and I was looking at something when Representative Dahl asked you the question. The term advantageous is also defined in the agency's common law, I take it.
Through the chair, yes, we've been through many protests and appeals and lawsuits where that language was contained in bids, and I couldn't say for sure that the term was ever challenged or...
As long as there are decisions, you know, we need to have on the record here the fact that there's a very specialized area of the law, and they have administrative law judges who deal pretty strictly with your department, and that these terms are defined so that even though we may not in the legislature be familiar with them, they are defined and they are, there's no question, you don't have it in the statute, but there's a common law in the agency, and I just wanted to establish that through the chair. That is correct, is it not, sir?
Mr. Chair, Representative Gruenberg, we've certainly had numerous protests and appeals and lawsuits using the RFP with that language was contained in it.
Thank you.
Thank you. Any further questions? Seeing none, I want to thank the sponsor, and at this point, I want to make a motion.
Just going back. I am going on your assurance, both of you, through the chair, that this definitional section, which begins on page 4, line 9, which is a little bit different than the definitions in 36, 33, 38, is, in your opinion, not going to cause a legal problem, because we're not referring the bill to judiciary. There's not time to do that. And I just don't want to be buying a lawsuit goes up to the Supreme Court.
Representative Faircloth?
Mr. Chairman, I am happy to make a request of Ledge Legal to clarify the intent of the difference in the language. Would that meet the request?
I leave that through the chair. I leave that to you and the department to determine whether you wish to look to the AG and or legal services. I express no opinion on this, and I've just simply raised a question, and the field's got a ways to go, and I'm not going to raise any other questions or anything. I don't have any problem with moving the bill.
Okay, thank you. Representative Johnson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. With that, I would move CS for House Bill 406, designated as 25LS1487/E, dated 3/11/08, from committee with individual recommendation and attached zero physical notes.
Any objections? Seeing none, the bill has moved out of committee. Thank you. We will now move on to House Joint Resolution number 19.
Good job.
And would someone like to move this CS as a working draft for us, please?
Mr. Chairman.
Please, Representative Cockell.
I'd move that we adopt the e-version for CS for House Joint Resolution number 19, written by Luckup, dated 2/21/08.
Thank you.
Mr. Chairman?
Please.
First of all, my apologies. In 3.5 minutes, I am due to be with the rest of the leadership, speaking with the other body's leadership. So I'm going to leave it with my staff, Reneva Moss, to present the bill. And we have some staff here also with Representative Kawasaki's office who will help. But I'd just like to give a brief introduction to it.
Please.
Really brief. Mr. Chairman, since 2005, the Real ID issue has become kind of an interesting balance of really check somebody's ID that it really is who they say they are, and or have the federal government tell us that we have to do it or else. And so that de facto national ID card is something that I kick against significantly. The 2005 version has been modified through regulation. It's been rearranged once, but its original passing actually happened in an appropriation bill. And it was a lump that went thump in my mind.
It was a tsunami, right?
And then the way it looks now, Mr. Chairman, is that there will be kind of a division between the states and the feds. If the feds continue going down the road, unless we accept their ID requirements, we can't get into their federal buildings, as if the federal government is they and us and the states are we. And I just don't think we should divide the people of America up that way. And so it's kind of a top-down pressure that I think under the Article 10 of the Constitution requires us to say we don't think that that's the best way to go about it. And so we are a collection of states under Title 10, or Article 10. And and this is a little bit of a softball in that we're just saying we don't like it. There's two whereases in here that say we don't see the general interest. There are other laws going through here that say that we will not fund any of it. The trouble with some of that stuff is that there are things that we need to do that are very similar to what the Real ID Act requires. And so just to say we'll never implement any of it, I struggle with. So I think a resolution at least says we're watching it and we may not implement the way you want. And to me, it's whether or not we'll stand up to the feds on it. So that's kind of the general of it, and you can get through the specifics of this. And so with that, Mr. Chairman, I am going to sign this last bill that we passed out, and then I have to leave. Sorry.
And we are well aware of the work that you're going to be doing, and we appreciate it. So and I can assure you that we've dealt with your staff before, and you're in good hands.
Who are they?
Yeah.
With that being said, would you like to add any more comments to what's already been stated?
For the record, Reneva Moss, staff to Representative Coghill. Just to kind of amplify what Representative Coghill was saying, Article 10, if powers aren't delegated to the U.S. government by the Constitution, those are reserved to the states and the people. And I think here the people is the issue that Representative Coghill was trying to bring forth, because what Real ID says is if the states don't do what we tell you to do, we're not going to punish the states. We're not going to withdraw funds like they normally do. They're going to punish the people of the state, and they're going to punish them by not allowing them access to airports for travel, not allowing them access to federal facilities. And because of Amendment 10, we have to remember that states have been have had the administrative authority for driver's licenses for, best we can tell, 100 years. In May of 2008, when the federal government has threatened to cut off our citizens because we don't do what they tell them to do, 100 years, states have been regulating driver's licenses. So Representative Coghill cut this resolution down, first of all, because more people will read it because it's short, but because it points out that it's an unfunded mandate, it's contrary to the 10th Amendment, and they are punishing citizens for the actions of a government. So I think that pretty well covers the resolution. I've brought Brody from Representative Kawasaki's office. He's probably the most knowledgeable person in this building on the regulations for Real ID. But if he would like to expound any philosophical remarks from Representative Kawasaki, I would welcome him to do that.
Brody, state your name for the record, please.
For the record, Brody Anderson, staff to Representative Scott Kawasaki. Reneva has summed it up extremely well with the main premise of the in regards to the state's power to govern its own Department of Motor Vehicle without the overreaching power of the federal government coming in and dictating the standards. And that's at that point, there's one thing I would like to point out in the scope. The final rules that came out last month, about a little over a month and a half ago, one of the comments, there were a few comments made about travel, interstate travel, and quite a few people mentioned Alaska and Hawaii in particular, and when the Homeland Security put out their final comments, they basically skipped over the fact of the hindrance that Alaskans and Hawaii would have with the non-compliance of Real ID and then how we would be, and they totally skipped over that. They didn't even address it. They said, we don't find this an issue of interstate travel. This won't impede people to travel between states because all we're doing is saying you cannot fly on federally regulated commercial airlines, end of story, and they didn't address that. And that's something that's still a great concern for us, because if you don't have a Real ID compliant card, you don't have your passport, then you, in essentially, are landlocked in Alaska. And that's something that we really would like to point out. The fact is, just one example of a direct issue.
Thank you. Representative Dahl.
Well, obviously, I agree with this because I'm a signer on the bill. But I do have a question. What would be the – are there any unintended consequences of this, something that we should – I mean, is – what is the impact of this resolution, and what would we be?
Through the chair, Representative Dahl, this resolution is softball, really, when you compare it to other states and what they have passed in resolutions. In fact, many states have actually passed statutes that prohibit the use of state funds to implement Real ID. And Representative Hill contemplated the wording in this resolution for quite a while, because he does realize that times are different and there are things that we're going to have to do differently. But he wants to get the message across that the federal government needs to work with states to make this country safer. They don't need to order states under unfunded mandates to do things that are contrary to what states have been doing for 100 years. And the big message that he wants to bring across to the federal government is, you don't punish our people for our actions. If you have problems with us, you deal with us one-on-one. And as far as consequences, I remember when Representative Coghill first came to the legislature, he had a bill that removed the Social Security number from hunting and fishing licenses. And we were told the state would lose federal dollars if we passed that legislation. And in researching the bill, we found that Montana and Colorado had already done this, and they had lost no federal dollars. And to my knowledge, we haven't lost a penny because of that legislation.
Representative Gruber.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. The members of the committee who are here today were not on this committee in the 24th state legislature when we had extensive hearings on the implementation of the Real ID Act by the then director of the Division of Motor Vehicles, who no longer serves in that position, by the way. A lawsuit was subsequently brought because, at least in some of our opinions, and I think the record will support this, they published a regulation that implemented the Real ID without any statutory authority whatsoever. The regulation was subsequently dismissed on a technicality, which I was very unfortunate. I think it was a well-taken lawsuit. And that regulation is still hanging out there, in my opinion, entirely illegally. And that director is gone. I am sorely tempted to want to say something about that in here, but I'm going to keep my amendment in my pocket unless the sponsor would like to see that added. But this is a very serious liability that the state faces, and frankly is chilled because a private citizen, if the state Supreme Court were to rule in favor of the state, this private individual who's acting really in the public interest would have to pay the state's attorney's fees. It's a result of a very, in my opinion, pernicious act he passed several years ago over my objection. And that's been upheld by the Supreme Court, which is another story. But I'm waxing and waning on this, and I am very concerned, but I assume the sponsor would not like to have anything in there about that. I'm going to call it a naked resolution.
Through the chair, Representative Gruenberg, thank you for bringing that up. This resolution is geared towards the federal government and their actions, but I think Representative Gruenberg brought up a very good point that we need to pursue. because it is true, and it is also true that the former director of DMV is no longer with us, and it should be corrected.
Corrected, you said? Yes. I just call that to the committee's attention. You're, as they said in the Phantom comic strip, coming in late on that, but it's, I think, very serious. Thank you.
Any further questions from the committee? Seeing none, Representative Johnson.
Mr. Chairman, I would move and ask unanimous consent, or would I don't do that. CS for House Bill Joint Resolution Number 19 pass out of committee with individual recommendations, and there is no fiscal note.
Seeing no objection, so moved.
Thank you.
Now go on to House Joint Resolution 37.
This resolution has taken a long time to get here.
Did I skip one? Mm-hmm. Oh, sorry, 38. Missed one.
Now, don't get him out of order.
No, I didn't want Representative Grunberg to get too excited. We're going to delay it a little longer.
It's only been 60 years.
Is that all? Just 60? Okay, House Joint Resolution Number 38. Who do we have presenting us?
Could I? Sure. Oh, my goodness.
We're going to lose the quorum.
Just could we stand at ease for 1 second, please, while staff is out here? I have a bill up in another committee. Is that what you're talking about?
Just take temporary at ease.
We have.
Do you need to testify?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'm Christopher Clark with House Speaker John Harris. We thank you for sponsoring and scheduling this resolution today that recognizes the 60th anniversary of the State of Israel, which happens on May 14th. And just want to thank you for all your work on this and urge your support moving it out of committee. And I'm here to answer any questions that you may have on that.
Representative Grunberg.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I thought we were going to get an email or something from you on some suggestions.
I have spoken with several members of the Jewish community in Juneau and so forth, and one of the recommended changes was a simple one, page 2, line 14, change the perfect tense, have shared, simply to share, whereas the American people share an affinity with the people of Israel and regard Israel as a strong and trusted ally. And, of course, we have no objection to that.
Was there any other, through the chair, any other changes?
And through the chair, the other change was simply adding that a copy of the resolution be sent to the Secretary of State, Condoleezza Rice. And, again, we have no objection to that either.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Grunberg.
Are you entertaining amendments at this time?
Please.
Okay, I would move on page 2, line 14, to strike the phrase, quote, have shared, unquote, and insert share.
So basically removing the word half.
Yes, in accord with the testimony just now. Did staff need to be here?
Any objection?
I just ask, do we need to have our staff here to do that? Okay, fine. Thank you.
Okay. Is there another amendment?
Yes.
Representative Grunberg?
The final copies paragraph on line 29, have the Secretary of State Condoleezza Rice.
Any objection to that amendment? Seeing none, so moved. Any other questions or comments? Representative Grunberg, did you want to make a motion?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Move the bill with individual recommendations, the resolution.
Any objection? As amended. Any objection? Seeing none, so moved.
Thank you.
I missed an amendment here.
Yeah,
we will show.
So Kevin would like to come back. And he wants to rebut something that Bloomberg said.
Okay.
So I don't know how to do that.
Oh, we're going
to
make it.
Who wants to come? Uh-oh. Somebody wants to. Somebody wants to.
On.
I guess it's too late. Somebody was going to rebut something.
I would like to. With the committee's indulgence for a moment, I did have someone that wanted to testify on House Joint Resolution 19 that we just passed. And in our haste to try and move that bill before we lost quorum, I overlooked the fact that Kevin Brooks wanted to testify on that bill. So, Kevin, if you'd like to come forward and at least give us your testimony on the concerns that you had, and I apologize for getting in a hurry and missing your
your request, so please.
Mr. Chairman, thank you very much. For the record, my name is Kevin Brooks. I'm the Deputy Commissioner for the Department of Administration, and Division of Motor Vehicles is one of our divisions. I appreciate the work on the joint resolution. I just wanted to inform the committee of some of the work that has been going on with relation to the Real ID Act and how Alaska is responding to that.
Just a moment, please.
Could we just have
just a brief adius, and then we'll...
Yeah, thank you.
Sorry.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And to be clear, I don't want to... I'm not here to dispute the passage of that the joint resolution, because certainly the administration has some very strong concerns about Real ID as well. And I appreciate the sponsor's comments that, you know, the regulations, if anyone's looked at those that passed last month, or I guess maybe it was January now, there are nearly 200 pages of rules, and some of those are good, and some Alaska is already doing, and they make sense from a business perspective that we do those. Our concerns, like yours, are that we have an unfunded mandate placed upon the state, and we're trying to estimate the cost that it would take if Alaska were to comply. I also want to let the committee know that Alaska has applied and received an extension. It doesn't commit us to comply at a later date, but we, along with 44 other states, have applied for that. It's through December of 2009. In the meantime, we continue to analyze those rules and see how they would impact us, and we're testifying on other pieces of legislation that are moving. But there are things that the state does that arguably are in compliance with the Real ID Act, but they don't make us compliant, if that distinction is clear. So we are working with the governor through the National Governors Association is working with other states, as are we, in trying to be responsible in our approach, but also preserving the rights of Alaska and its citizens. Because, as was pointed out, one of the biggest impacts, if Real ID were to pass and we were not compliant, would be on our citizens trying to get on an airplane. And Alaska and Hawaii, as has been pointed out, are more reliant on air travel than any other states of the union. I also, Mr. Chairman, wanted to comment that there were comments made on regulations that were passed.
Could we take that up on Saturday?
Yes.
Okay, thank you. Could we be excused, Mr. Chairman?
No, please. If we just let him finish his testimony,
excuse
and then
me.
We'll go.
Sorry.
Thank you. Just take a moment.
That's fine.
I appreciate it.
I apologize for interrupting.
If I can, the reason for the delay there is we have about six things going on at the same time, and we're about to lose our quorum, and they're just informing me, but they are going to stay until you finish your testimony.
I just wanted to get on the record, since it was placed before, that the department passed regulations a couple years ago. Those regulations did not implement the Real ID Act. We are not compliant today. We weren't when they passed the regulations. The regulations that passed were the result of about a two-year effort to update the DMV regs. They had not been updated in over a decade. There were numerous references to the Division of Motor Vehicles when it existed in the Department of Public Safety. The regs that we passed reflected that the DMV was now in the Department of Administration, and updated the division's rules with current statute, not with any prospective statute that had yet to pass. And I want to be very clear about that. There are references made to a former director who is no longer working for the administration, but that had there is no relationship with his no longer working for us in the passage of those regulations. We believe the regs were the result of a good work effort by a lot of people with comprehensive legal review. They withstood the test of a lawsuit, and we stand by those regulations. So I want to get that on the record, because they did not implement the Real ID Act.
Representative Grunberg.
Thank you. I'm just going to, rather than going point by point with you, sir, is it not true that they did not reach the issue of the legality of the regulations in that lawsuit, that they dismissed it because the named plaintiff didn't have standing? Isn't that correct? It was a written opinion, and I can distribute that if you dispute what I said.
Through the chair, Representative Grunberg, that's an accurate statement.
Thank you. I'm not going to ask any other questions.
in the interest of time.
Any other questions?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you, and I apologize for not getting on the record before we moved the bill. And
I understand.
Got covered underneath, and again, I apologize, and thank you very much.
Thank you.
With that, we are going to take the next resolution, which is House Joint Resolution 37, and we're going to move that to first on the calendar for our Saturday meeting. And with that, we are going to adjourn for today.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.